This is an ABC podcast.
Welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. This is David Rutledge. How are you doing this week? How's your work-life balance looking? How's your bank balance looking? How's the outlook for your future material and financial security? Well, if the answer to all those questions is bleak or even just could be better, then you're going to be interested in today's program because we're talking about a very troubling social development that could be ushering in the end of capitalism. And while for a lot of people on the political left, the end of capitalism sounds like a wonderful idea, what if capitalism ended, but then it was replaced by something worse, something that looks more like feudalism, a society structured around peasants and overlords?
Larger and larger swathes of the population are going to be viewed as surplus to the economy. They're just simply not needed in order for the very wealthy and for elites to profit. You see increasing levels of chronic illness and drug addiction, and really you begin to see the sort of breakdown of society in various kind of ways. You have smaller and smaller urban hubs where there are good jobs and where it is possible still to have a fairly good standard of living. And then there are these large enclaves of the country where people increasingly rely on subsistence to get by.
That's Francis Russell. He's a lecturer in the Faculty of Humanities at Curtin University in Perth, and his research looks at contemporary forms of alienation. That's certainly a growth industry these days, and recently Francis Russell has been thinking about neo-feudalism, this idea that as wealth becomes concentrated in the hands of fewer and fewer people, life becomes more and more precarious for the masses, and the state becomes less and less able or inclined to intervene, we could be heading in the direction of something that's roughly equivalent to a feudal society. And I say roughly equivalent because neo-feudalism is a somewhat controversial notion, certainly a contested notion, and I should also say that the nightmare future scenario we just heard sketched out is not something that Francis Russell himself considers to be inevitable. But regardless of what the future may or may not hold, the neo-feudalism thesis is very interesting and I think really valuable as a way of analysing certain worrying social and economic trends that are unfolding right now and unfolding very quickly. Francis Russell joins me now. Francis, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
Before we get to neo-feudalism, I'd like to talk a bit about exactly what we mean by feudalism, because feudalism is a system that historically has quite specific social and economic features. What are some of those?
I think particularly for our discussion, it's most useful to define feudalism against capitalism. And all of the figures involved in the refeudalization debate will acknowledge that feudalism is a contested term and that it means different things in different parts of Europe and in different parts of the world. But I think for our discussion, the really important distinctions are around probably four key factors. The first is what we could call the relative distance between the point of expropriation or dispossession and the point of production. So in a feudal society, the serfs or the commoner was largely left to their own devices in terms of how they worked and how they produced the things that people need to live day to day. The nobility didn't really want to know how you grew potatoes or exactly what the best way to harvest wheat was. That's largely left to the commoner to work out. But then through a use of force and the use of the legal system, the nobility would then simply dispossess you of a certain amount of the fruits of your labour. In a capitalist system, largely there is a direct involvement in the capitalist with how the production process occurs. So the duration of the working day, exactly how things are produced, when they're produced, how quickly they're produced, all of this is something that the capitalist has a really direct concern regarding. And importantly, it's not that as workers in a capitalist society, we're left to our own devices and then the bosses come along and just take things off us. But rather, we're paid to produce a commodity. We're paid to produce a commodity that can be sold for more than we were paid to produce it, and then a profit is produced. So economists would say that in feudalism, you don't have exploitation. You instead have expropriation. You just have things directly taken off you. The other thing that's important is that in a feudal system, you don't really have an overarching state that is interfering in the way that work is produced through industrial policy or something like that. Rather, you do have these little fiefdoms, these little parceled out bits of sovereignty And even if there is a king or there's someone sitting at the very top, usually there's a precarious relationship between them and these other somewhat semi-autonomous regions geographically. And what that also means is that there's a direct relationship in feudalism between politics, the law, and the economy, whereas in capitalism, those things are somewhat given a degree of autonomy. So in feudalism, if someone with political power can wield the law against you in a way that disadvantages you, there's very little that you can do about that. Whereas obviously in a capitalist system, even if people have criticisms or critiques, you can go to the Fair Work Commission or an Industrial Relations Commission, and you could use the law against an employer if you felt you have grounds to do so. The last thing, and this is maybe one of the most central differences between feudalism and capitalism, is that in capitalism, if we want anything in life, whether it's, you know, food, shelter, therapy, healthcare, whatever it is, somebody has to profit nearly always in order for us to receive that thing. So in capitalism, profit is central to social relationships, whereas in feudalism, profit is marginal to social relationships. Some historians would say there was commodity production in feudal societies, but that was really at the margins. For the most part, people got the things they needed through the direct kind of production and consumption of those things without the commodity sitting at the heart of organizing social life.
That's interesting. I mean, what you're describing sounds like a system under capitalism where there's just a lot more going on. You know, things are tightly controlled, tightly regulated, everything's sort of nailed down. There seems to be a kind of freedom under feudalism, but it's a freedom of all against all.
Sure. I mean, Marx would talk about capitalism as involving a very specific type of freedom, which is the freedom to no longer be bound to a particular lord or a particular aristocrat. So in capitalism, at least in theory, if you don't like your boss, you can quit and you can go get a new boss. And that's not something that you can do within a feudal society. But on the other hand, exactly as you've said, within a capitalist society, work and commodity production really does dominate so many factors of our life. Most people spend their life at work, and increasingly, and I mean, this is something that came up in one of your earlier episodes with Dr. Eva Bjorka, we're micromanaged in the workplace to such greater and greater degrees that in some way it is possible maybe to have a nostalgia for a sort of a medieval life where the natural rhythms of the seasons play a greater part in organizing social affairs.
Well, let's talk about refeudalization, because this is a term that comes up in 1962. We have Jürgen Habermas publishing his book, The Structural Transformation of the Public Sphere. And in that work, he writes about a process of refeudalization that he sees as taking place within the public sphere. What's he on about there?
So Habermas writes that book at a time where many philosophers in Europe are growing concerned about the failures of democracies to produce collective decision making and genuine participation. Obviously, with the Frankfurt School, there's a great deal of research done on the ways that the Nazis were able to manipulate the press and the public sphere in order to produce, you know, truly catastrophic consequences. And what I found really fascinating, David, listening to your interview with Christopher Voropil on Richard Rorty, I think Habermas has a really similar concern to Rorty. It's not just that he was concerned about the quality of individual facts within the public sphere, within the press or within journals or within open debate and discussion. He was also concerned whether the institutional forms that exist within capitalist democracies really produced a kind of open and reciprocal relationship between citizens, or whether increasingly those institutions were being manipulated for profit and were producing largely antagonistic relationships between groups that really would inhibit people from being actively involved in public and political life. Where Habermas draws on feudalism is that early in the book, he talks about the way that in feudal society, there's nothing like the public sphere that we see in a capitalist society. You don't have a free press. You don't have the ability for people to speak openly and freely in various institutions and forums. There's certainly no philosopher's zone in feudal Europe. But what he does see is a different type of publicness, which is the public display of power and authority that the nobility would perform. And they would perform that through their dress, through ceremonies, through festivals, by stamping their heads on coins. There were various ways that the feudal aristocracy would exhibit their power and their significance to the common person. And what Habermas meant by refeudalization is a concern that the media and the public sphere today functions largely to do something similar. It's being captured by an increasingly small number of powerful private citizens who utilize the media not so much to facilitate genuine debate and discussion about important issues, but rather to present themselves as being authorities that need people to be loyal to them and to trust them against their adversaries. And so I think if you look at a lot of the concerns about the way someone like Donald Trump used the media in the last few years, you can see that a lot of Habermas's concerns about the public sphere are as relevant today as they were in the 1960s. I suppose what's a little bit more debatable, and it was something that Habermas himself seemed to go back and forth on, is whether feudalism is the appropriate metaphor to describe something kind of new and insidious that's happening in liberal capitalist societies.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I want to pick that up in a second. But if we talk about neo-feudalism then, what exactly are we talking about? I mean, is this simply taking Habermas's insight and applying it to what's happening in the 21st century, or is there something more complex going on here?
I think that something really important is to think of the re prefix in re-feudalism as being sort of like the re in remix, because it's certainly not saying that capitalism is slipping back into the past and that modern societies are becoming more feudal. But instead, neo-feudalism or re-feudalism, or you even get the term techno-feudalism, is attempting to discuss the way that as capitalist societies are moving into the future, certain previously thought redundant or, you know, overcome social relations that were very prominent in feudalism are starting to reemerge, but they're also reemerging in ways that are sort of mutant and different. The sociologist Sighard Nekel has a really great evocative image of the dolly zoom or the vertigo effect, literally the vertigo effect from Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo. And he says that in filmmaking, the dolly zoom is a process where you draw the camera backwards as you zoom in with the lens, and it creates this distorting effect where the thing you're filming, the person you're filming, stays pretty much in normal proportions, but the background either zooms in or zooms out. And he says he wants to use refeudalization in a similar kind of a way to suggest that we're going forwards, but in a way that is weirdly bringing all of these repressed parts of earlier social relations back into the foreground.
And you said that this can be described as techno-feudalism. So we're talking there about the rise of big tech, these giant technology companies in particular, and how they're increasing economic dominance, social dominance, even political dominance, or certainly political influence, how this is all contributing to the rise of this neo-feudal order. Tell me about the tech companies. What are they doing in particular?
So particularly for people, prominent thinkers like the economist Yanis Varoufakis or the political philosopher Jody Dean, tech companies are really taken as paradigmatic of the refeudalization of capitalism, or as you've said, and Varoufakis prefers this terminology, techno-feudalism. And I think there's at least two ways to think about why these companies like Alphabet, Meta, Amazon have become central in this story. The first is that often these tech companies make enormous amounts of money, not primarily through wage labor, not primarily through hiring people, paying them to produce a commodity and then selling that commodity at a profit. But instead, they function in a way that is closer to feudal expropriation or dispossession. And that's something that I can elaborate on in a second. The second point is that there's a monopolistic approach to intellectual property rights by these tech giants. And that means that there is increasingly not only kind of a semi-sovereignty to these companies, they become so large and ingrained in various aspects of society that there's a concern that they almost function like mini states in and of themselves. But also their monopoly gives them an increased capacity to extract rents at various points of the production process. to elaborate on the first point, so if you imagine you're walking along in your day-to-day life, you're using your phone, you're using Twitter, you're using Facebook, you're producing content that is really exciting people. It's making people want to use these platforms more and more. They're going, David, another amazing insight about philosophy on Twitter. This is why I log on to X, as it's now called, right? Now, at no point does Elon Musk say, David, you're not tweeting in the right way. We need you to be posting more about this, and we need you to be making this many posts a day, and this is how we want to structure the commodity that we're selling on. Instead, largely, you're free to go about your business, doing what you see fit, with some minor regulations. But the terms and services of the platform say that the company is entitled to the data surplus that you're producing. So similarly to a feudal lord, there's not really much involvement in how you go about producing the content that you're producing and the data that you're producing. But through an extra economic legal process of expropriation, the owners of these companies simply get to take data that otherwise you might think that they don't really have a right to. And we can see that happening in other companies as well. Uber or Airbnb, they don't buy houses, they don't buy cars. They don't really provide very much in the way of capital, but instead what they do is they impose a rent on drivers who want access to customers. So as a driver, if I want to know where are people who need a lift, I have to pay a portion of my earnings to Uber. Otherwise, I just simply won't have that kind of access. Now, the second point about monopoly, and the work of Celia Reicap is really, really useful here, shows that in the sort of conventional way we understand capitalism, when a firm introduces a technological innovation, there might be a small window where they can produce new commodities, produce commodities quicker, and make more money that way, or they can extract rents from other firms. But eventually, other firms catch up. They realize that they can use similar technologies or similar processes, and there's less profit to be made because everybody is kind of, reached the same level. But Reicap points out that some of these enormous tech companies like Amazon, Alphabet, and Microsoft, they own so much of the cloud computing industry. They are just simply so dominant in the way that data is stored and processed and sold on that it's virtually impossible for other firms to compete with them. In order to buy the servers you would need to compete in the cloud storage market, you would just need capital that it's not possible to get at an early stage. But also these companies often will be funding the very startups that are quote unquote competing with them, except in ways where they maintain intellectual property rights over everything that is kind of produced. So that's why there's been a borrowing of the study of feudalism and this notion of parcelized sovereignty to talk about whether or not these firms are so monopolistic and they've outgrown other companies to such extent that they almost function somewhat like miniature states.
On Radio National and the ABC Listen app, this is The Philosopher's Zone with me, David Rutledge, and my guest this week is Francis Russell from Curtin University in Perth. We're talking about neo-feudalism, this idea that Western liberal democracies like the USA could be devolving into societies that make the miseries and injustices of capitalism look like a stroll in the park. So just to be clear here, can you elaborate a little more on this term rent and on the logic of rent and dispossession as opposed to the familiar capitalist logic of profit and accumulation? How are they different?
Normally, when we think about rents, we think about something that we extract profit from without adding anything to the productive capacities of the economy. And so, a simple way of thinking about it, if I buy a house and then I rent it out, I haven't produced a house. The house was already there. In terms of the sum total of houses available for people to live in, I've merely taken possession of it. And then I generate a profit, not by adding something to the economy per se, but being a barrier to somebody. Effectively, if you want to live here, then you need to pay me money. And so all commodities arguably involve some degree of rent. For instance, if I produce a new miracle drug, that's something new that's in the economy. But then I'm concerned that the customer's not going to know that this is a miracle drug, and so I hire a marketing firm. Now, the marketing firm's not really adding anything to the economy. What they're doing is helping me to profit more by getting my commodity out there to as many people as possible.
The middleman.
A middleman, exactly. Yeah. And so that could be seen as a rent. And so arguably, I mean, a Marxist economist like David Harvey would say probably all commodities involve a degree of rent. The argument, though, with some of these tech giants is that largely they're not producing anything at all, but instead are installing themselves into more and more aspects of the way that we produce commodities, where we can't help but pay rents to these companies. To go back to an example of Uber, something Uber has done that's been highly effective is to effectively destroy or heavily weaken cab services and other companies that they may have once competed within. Once they've done that, it means that anybody who wants to drive a car and receive money for it is increasingly forced to utilize their network, to utilize their platform in order to make a living. And the argument would be that they're not really adding anything to the productive capacity. They're not buying cars and they're not creating jobs per se. But what they are doing is acting as a kind of a middleman that profits merely by extracting a rent.
And they're not operating within a market either, are they? Or at least they are operating within a market, but only insofar as it allows them to attack or weaken market forces. There's not much in the way of competition going on.
Absolutely. And I mean, Peter Thiel, who is, you know, a famous venture capitalist, and he's a figure that often comes up in the literature around refutilization. You know, he wrote an article a number of years ago saying, you know, in praise of monopolies and boo for competition. He was arguing that competition is fundamentally inefficient. It's better to have these enormous monopolistic companies because they can provide better outcomes for customers. But the question of competition comes up a lot in refutilization. And I can give you a slightly different example. In some of the sociological literature about the topic, a question is raised around executive promotion and executive salaries. So to give you an example from my own sector, in higher education in Australia, for years now, people have wondered, why is it that vice chancellors get paid anywhere between $800,000 to $1.5 million. And if you go to an organization like the National Tertiary Education Union, they'll say, well, senior managers always tell us that's because it's just what the market rate is. If you want a really skilled vice chancellor, you just got to pay $1.5 million. But there'd be an argument of, what kind of market are we talking about here? Really, the sociological literature would suggest that the people who are at the top of a lot of big companies exist within political networks where they're able to leverage their influence and their status to gain very, very high-paying jobs without really much competition, certainly not the kind of competition that exists a lot lower down the spectrum. And so economists like Thomas Piketty have noticed that increasingly within capitalism, being married to the right people, having the right friends is far more important than any notion of performance. The idea that any amount of performance can give you a $500,000 or $10 million pay increase is sort of bizarre. And so again, that would be viewed as being perhaps more similar to feudal societies in which a sort of cadre of aristocrats would marry into each other's families and forge alliances to maintain as much of society's surplus as possible.
Back to this notion of productivity. I mean, you've explained it really well. Okay, so if I have a house, I rent one out. Or if I have two houses, I rent one out. I'm getting an income that's disconnected from the creation or provision of goods and services. It's not like I'm getting money from making some useful thing and then selling it to people. So that's rent. But isn't there a sense in which these big tech companies are in fact very productive? There's this article that I know you're familiar with by Evgeny Morozov in the New Left Review from a couple of years ago. And he makes the point that companies like Meta, Alphabet, Amazon, they employ vast numbers of workers. They invest heavily in research and development. They run huge data centers and other physical networks like warehouses. Isn't there more going on here than just rent seeking?
I think that's a really good point, and I would want to give Morozov his credit. I think he does a lot to argue that potentially it's a form of mystification and something maybe we could get into later, that it's also politically weak to try to use feudalism as a kind of a metaphor, and that really we're better just thinking about this as being late-stage capitalism. You bring up a really important point that some of these large tech firms do invest huge amounts of money in research and development, and so that's not really what a kind of a landlord does, or a lord who just owns a water mill that the peasants have to pay some kind of rent to use. It's not traditional that a rent seeker invests, you know, huge amounts of their profit into research and development. However, other theorists would argue that that research and development investment is largely done in order to shore up monopoly and in order to extract more rents. And so the theorist Celia Reichap has this wonderful phrase about the tech giants are proactive rentiers, which means that they're rent seekers, but they're rent seekers who invest in order to create further monopoly that they can then extract more rent from. So an example of this, Microsoft spend huge amounts of money and work with literally thousands of scientific research groups all over the world in order to try to produce new digital services, to innovate in the space of artificial intelligence. But at every level, Microsoft have the intellectual property rights to everything that is done. So effectively, the more that they research and the more that they invest, the more that they create the necessity of paying rents to Microsoft in order to have access to any of these kinds of innovations. Some people would say too that that has a damaging effect on productivity and growth overall, because even if there is research and investment going on, it's always within the short-termist logics of these companies. You're not really going to see the kind of blue sky thinking that might open up new business models or new ways of working, because so much of it is connected to just a handful of enormous companies.
So where in all this is the state? What's the role of the state here? Because it seems that the neo-feudal order is one where the state is weak, relatively disempowered, with sovereignty handed over to the Peter Thiels and the other techno-lords. Is that how you see it?
Look, personally, I think this is one of the most debatable parts of the refeudalization literature. And I'm sort of agnostic on this front, but I'll give you the two sides. There is an acknowledgement that increasingly the state has functioned to empower private individuals and monopolistic firms. So we've seen, you know, at least since the 1980s, changes in tax policy that have meant the 1% have gained enormously, whereas the 99% have really struggled in terms of stagnant wages, in terms of, you know, diminishing standards of living. There's also a sense in which industrial policy often favours these tech giants. So the state ensures that there are, also, particularly in America, there's all sorts of incentives for universities and for public organizations to work with Amazon and similar kind of companies. And also there's been a squeamishness on the part of the state to look at the way these companies offshore their intellectual property rights or often offshore their assets so that they can avoid paying taxes and these kinds of things. Interestingly, though, that's produced a really polarizing interpretation within the refeudalization debate. The weddedness of the state to these incredibly wealthy firms and individuals has caused one side of the debate to go, see, the state's basically disintegrating, we're returning to something more like feudalism where you have a bunch of little semi-sovereign operators. And another side has gone, no, these firms wouldn't be able to function at all without a strong state there to back them up. Look at what happened with quantitative easing in the GFC, where the state needed to, through the central banks, print tons of money to keep the economy afloat. Or even look at what happened in COVID, where the state was invoked in order to, you know, pay people who were not able to work. So it really depends on whether or not you see the state as playing the role of challenging and sort of maintaining some kind of distance between these companies and the rest of society, or whether you're a bit more pessimistic. And I guess if you're a bit more pessimistic, you would say, this isn't refeudalization, this is just neoliberalism. This is just the state being beholden to these private interests in the way that it has done for potentially the last 50 years.
So, Francis, what are the politics around all this? If we look at developments in political thinking, political philosophy over the past few years, what do we see that helps us to understand how we got to this point?
There's two points that I would make. The first is, coming off the back of the failure of the Jeremy Corbyn campaign and the Bernie Sanders campaign, and also the failure of various other sort of left-wing projects across the world, I think there's been an acknowledgement that there is a polarization between, on the one hand, a young, downwardly mobile left-wing contingent and an increasingly sort of right-wing, largely baby boomer, kind of petty bourgeoisie that has a bit more money and a bit more access to assets. And there's been an acknowledgement that in some ways the Sanders campaign and the Corbyn campaign and this attempt to sort of bring social democracy back after so many years of neoliberalism maybe failed because the left weren't able to get the quote-unquote petty bourgeois back on board with the project. I think in some ways this whole discussion about refeudalization is an attempt to offer a critique of capitalism that doesn't have to talk about capitalism too much. What it can do is effectively say, look, maybe you think capitalism is great, let's not get into that discussion, but this is something worse. This isn't capitalism anymore, but this is the return of unchecked political power from a very small group of people, and it's something that we all need to band together and fight. Other people have criticized this sort of rhetorical strategy on the grounds that it inevitably then paints the past as having been some kind of a golden era that we have to return to. That, you know, during capitalism, there was, you know, greater fairness, there was greater ability for people to become upwardly socially mobile, and therefore that we need to return to some kind of a heyday. There'd be an argument that that's not only maybe politically weak, because you're not offering people a new compelling vision of the future. You're instead just saying that we need to return to the golden days of the past as the horizon darkens. But also, some philosophers would say that it's just conceptually confused. Capitalism, on their argument, has always involved certain factors that belonged to feudal societies. So expropriation or the rent-seeking behaviours of powerful firms, the argument would go, that's always been part of capitalism. And so it's sort of conceptually confusing to try to give that an entirely different label like neo-feudalism.
Well, if we can maybe do a little bit of dystopian crystal ball gazing, when you look at the possible future as an age of serfdom, what do you see that qualifies it as such in terms of how ordinary people might actually come to live? Can you sketch out, you know, a sort of a nightmare scenario of how society might look a few decades from now when neo-feudalism has really taken hold? What are we all doing?
Yeah, well, get the dramatic strings playing in the background, because, I mean, I think the scariest version of the future comes from Yanis Varoufakis. So Varoufakis would say that the thing that woke him out of his dogmatic slumber was noticing that during COVID, there was this exploding profit in the financial markets as the real economy crashed. And for him, that showed that there was now a complete disconnect between the way that financial power was able to profit enormously, even if people literally are not working, they're not producing anything, and the real economy is kind of shutting down. What that would suggest for someone like Varoufakis is increasingly larger and larger swathes of the population are going to be viewed as surplus to the economy. They're just simply not needed in order for the very wealthy and for elites to profit. And so potentially what you're already seeing in America and what's referred to as the epidemic of deaths of despair might be on the horizon, where greater numbers of people leave the labor force altogether. They're not unemployed because they're actually not looking for work. You see increasing levels of chronic illness and drug addiction, and really you begin to see the sort of breakdown of society in various kind of ways. Jody Dean has referred to that as the hinterlandization of America, where you have smaller and smaller urban hubs where there are good jobs and where it is possible still to have a fairly good standard of living. And then there are these large enclaves of the country where people increasingly rely on subsistence to get by. But also it has interesting political ramifications. Some sociologists have looked at the seemingly spontaneous and largely organized online activist movements that we've seen, whether it's Occupy Wall Street, whether it's the Black Lives Matter movement. And they've looked at these fermentations of often very justifiable anger online that explode out into the streets in weeks of protest that then dissolve as if they never took place at all. And some theorists have looked at that and said these kinds of protests are most similar to peasant uprisings that would happen in the medieval period, where peasants were experiencing hardships to a point where they would say, we're not going to take it anymore. They would burn some things down. They would get some brief concessions, and then it would just be back to life as normal. And I think that some of the more pessimistic proponents of the refeudalization discourse say that's what's more and more going to be on the horizon. You're not going to see the kind of liberal politics of trade unions and political parties getting together to mobilize people in order to, you know, make changes at the level of policy and law, but instead largely spontaneous and online mediated explosions of anger into the streets that then sort of impotently fizzle away. I would say those are some of the most pessimistic views. I wouldn't personally share those ideas. And I would say that what's often missing from the discourse of refeudalization is precisely people's ability to change society and to act politically. That there can sometimes be almost a bit of a kind of a technological determinism in this discourse, where it's assumed that the current kind of trends in the economy are just there to stay and there's not much that we can do about it.
Well, let's elaborate a little on that more optimistic note to finish up with. I mean, how do you think it's possible to arrest or mitigate the process of refeudalization? It's a terrible question to end on. This should be the first question in a whole new interview. But just to take us out, what are some hopeful notes maybe?
I think this is where we can come back to Habermas and to his interest in refeudalization in relation to the public sphere. I do think something that is desperately needed is the rebuilding of institutions that can give people a forum to engage in collective discussion, collective action, and the formation of a bold new vision of what the future is and what the future should be. I think that it is concerning that increasingly the very means we have to communicate and to come together are privatized and are pushed towards forms of social dissonance that mean it's very, very difficult for people to, you know, meaningfully organize themselves. So I think in some ways Habermas has a real point that it is absolutely fundamental that there are institutions that don't just censor fake news or fact check individuals, but actually create this sort of institutional conditions for real interpretation, for meaningful engagement. But also, I mean, I'm a philosopher, but I'm also a trade unionist. I do really believe that what is also really fundamental is that within the trade union movement, there's an acknowledgement that the ways people work are increasingly changing, and that people often, if they're organizing their work through apps, there are not shared spaces on a work site where people can come together and talk about the ways they feel that they're being exploited and better ways that they could work and live. I think one of the challenges we need to face and that we are trying to face is the way that increasingly these tech companies connect people, but connect them through atomization, where it's more and more difficult for people to come together. But, you know, I am confident that people, you know, increasingly understand it and are attempting to find ways to rebuild solidarity and to rebuild collective movements.
Francis Russell, lecturer in the Faculty of Humanities at Curtin University in Perth. More information on the website. This has been the Philosopher's Zone, and you can stream or download this and all of our past programs via the ABC Listen app. Thanks so much for your company this week. It's been great to have you along. I'm David Rutledge, and I hope you can join me next time.
If you're still up for tackling some of life's big questions, join me, James Valentine, on my podcast, Headroom, the Belief Series.
I didn't feel like I had to find another belief, but it was an absence and it was a real dark night of the soul.
On this, I sit down with a number of interesting Australians to ask, what do you believe?
Even if you only believe that your avocado sandwich is the best avocado sandwich there's ever been.
Dive deep into the beliefs of people like George Miller, Richard Feidler, Claire Wright, William Barton, and more on Headroom, the Belief Series, available on the ABC Listen app.